The time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Wednesday, April 10th, 2024. I'm your host, Vicki Iden.
And I'm your host, Marcus Slayton. In tonight's news, the EPA announces drinking water standards for PFAS chemicals.
Clean energy construction projects accelerate in Wisconsin.
The UW-Madison campus continues to reckon with its history.
And in the second half, we take a closer look at how two constitutional amendments will impact election clerks, get some insight from a former art curator at Momoka, and travel back in time for headlines from 62 years ago.
All these and more on tonight's news, but first we'll go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. Three sons of Hamas's political leader Ismail Haniyeh have been killed in an Israeli airstrike. The car in which they were travelling, reportedly to a family Eid celebration, was all but destroyed in the attack. Hamas said four of Mr. Haniyeh's grandchildren were also killed. Israel said the sons had carried out what it called terrorist activities. Our international editor Jeremy Bowen has more.
It's possible that this was something to do with the ceasefire talks because, of course, Ismail Haniyeh is the senior Hamas political leader outside Gaza. And when he was told about this, he said, "The blood of my sons and grandchildren is no more precious than any other Palestinian. We will not change our position in the talks." Their position in the talks is really quite entrenched. In return for a ceasefire and them giving up all the hostages, they want Israel out of Gaza for good and all. Now, the Israelis are not going to accept that because they want to go into Rafah in the south and finish off, as they see it, the remnants of Hamas. So that is no recipe for a ceasefire.
After years of negotiation, the European Parliament has approved a sweeping reform of the EU's migration and asylum rules. It'll toughen border controls, speed up deportations, and require member states to share responsibility for refugees. The European Commission president said it addressed one of the main concerns of Europeans. Both Hungary and Poland have said they won't accept the migrant relocation scheme. The Democratic Party in South Korea has strengthened its majority in parliament, with nearly all votes counted from Wednesday's election. Together with its smaller ally, it's on course to win over 170 of the 300 seats in the National Assembly. The result is a blow to President Yoon Suk-yeol and leaves him weakened for the final years of his term. The ruling military junta in Mali has suspended all political activities in the country till further notice. A spokesman said the suspension was motivated by what he called sterile discussions during an attempt at national dialogue earlier this year. Julian Bedford reports.
Opposition groups in Mali and the international community have been urging the military leadership to make good on their promise to restore democracy 4 years after they seized power. A presidential vote, which had been scheduled for February, was postponed and no new date has yet been set. Just last week, opposition parties called for elections to be held as soon as possible. The public enthusiasm that greeted the wave of coups across the Sahel is ebbing, as the military authorities fare little better than their democratically elected counterparts in ending the jihadist violence that has long been people's main concern.
BBC News. The United States and Japan have announced what they called a new era of strategic cooperation with the building of a joint air and missile defense system. Speaking alongside the visiting Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, President Biden said the upgraded military pact was strictly defensive. For his part, Mr. Kishida emphasized the importance of a free and open Indo-Pacific region based on the rule of law, amid a perceived growing threat from China in the South China Sea and around Taiwan. Canada's government says it's preparing for another potentially devastating wildfire season after a warmer than normal winter left little snow accumulation on the ground, compounding droughts in several regions. Last year's wildfire season saw more than 15 million hectares of forest go up in smoke and 230,000 people displaced. Police in the U.S. city of Philadelphia say at least two people have been shot at an Eid celebration marking the end of Ramadan. Four people have been arrested and a number of weapons seized. Those shot were outside a mosque where there's reported to have been an argument. Nevaeh Myers witnessed the attack.
Everybody started running everywhere. Oh my gosh, they're shooting. Everybody's running over each other. I'm helping people up. It was crazy. The little kids are shot. Everybody got blood all over them. We're Muslim. It's Eid Mubarak. This is supposed to be one of the best days of the year for us. I don't understand why they came there shooting. They had a big AK. It was huge.
Prosecutors in Peru have seized from a regional governor luxury jewellery worn by the president, Dina Boluarte. She's under investigation for corruption after being spotted wearing three Rolex watches and one bracelet. Last week, she said they weren't hers, but her friend and political allies, Wilfredo Oscarima, and she'd returned them. BBC News.
This is Vicki Iden and Marcus Slayton with your local news coming to you from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Here are tonight's headlines. The Biden administration is urging a federal appeals court to reconsider a low court's order to shut down the Enbridge Line 5 oil pipeline. That's according to a legal filing made public today, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. The Line 5 pipeline carries 540,000 barrels of oil per day from Superior to Ontario, and some of it runs through sovereign land in Wisconsin. In 2019, the Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa in northern Wisconsin sued Enbridge to remove the pipeline from their reservation after voicing concerns that it might rupture into the Bad River. Last year, federal judge William Conley ordered parts of the pipeline to be shut down and ordered Enbridge to pay the Bad River Band more than $5 million as compensation for trespassing. Both sides appealed the decision to the Seventh Circuit Appeals Court. In the brief released today, the federal government agrees with Conley that Enbridge's Line 5 trespasses on Bad River land, but contests the decision to suspend oil operations along the pipeline, and that the money awarded to Bad River in damages is too low in light of the profit Enbridge makes on the pipeline. The filing shows the Biden administration opposes shutting down the pipeline because it would interrupt the flow of oil to Canada and would violate a 1977 treaty.
State elections officials have affirmed today that an effort to recall State Assembly Speaker Robin Voss fell short of the required number of valid signatures. Staff at the Wisconsin Elections Commission released a memo today that outlined their review, reports the Associated Press. That's after members of a coalition to recall Voss submitted thousands of signatures that were collected from three voting districts that were appropriate for Voss, with many signatures collected from districts where Voss neither lives nor represents. The Elections Commission is expected to finalize the staff memo with an announcement tomorrow.
Governor Evers has signed a new law that broadens criteria used to issue alerts for missing children in the state. The Prince Act is named after a young child who went missing last year and was later found dead. It's intended to allow the use of a silver alert for missing children if the circumstances do not meet the criteria of an amber alert. Currently, the silver alert is used for spreading information about missing adults, while an amber alert is issued for a child where there is reason to believe the child was abducted and in jeopardy of being seriously harmed or killed. Under the new law, a silver alert could be used for a missing person under 18 if the person is considered to be unable to return home on their own due to a, quote, physical or mental condition or disability, unquote, or if they are under 10 years old.
A recount for one Eastern Dane County Board seat is slated for this Friday, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. That's after IT professional David Peterson eked out a 6-vote win over Lorene Gage, a middle school English teacher and president of the Monona School Board. Both were vying to represent District 36, which encompasses Eastern Dane County and includes Cottage Grove. Peterson got 1,428 votes, a 6-vote lead over Gage's, who got 1,422 votes. There are also 68 write-in votes in the race. A tight win qualifies a candidate to ask for a free recount, and that's exactly what would happen Friday morning at 9:15 at the City County Building.
The search for a private partner in a Southside redevelopment project has been narrowed down to three finalists. Madison's Community Development Authority, or CDA, is looking to revitalize the old transit transfer point at the corner of South Park Street and Badger Road, and they're searching for a development partner first. A request for proposals states that they're looking to add several hundred units of affordable and mixed-income housing. They're also looking to build a new space for Madison's Fire Station No. 6 and Public Health Madison and Dane County, reports Isthmus Newspaper. The redevelopment project is part of the South Madison Renaissance, a community-led effort to remake that part of town without displacing current residents. Six applicants submitted proposals for the private partnership. That's been narrowed down to the Urban League of Greater Madison, the Alexander Company, and Bear Development. The CDA board is slated to interview those finalists tomorrow in a public meeting and may go into closed session to make their selection.
A Madison area cat could win a big honor in a national pet contest put on by Nationwide Pet Insurance. Car Alarm is the cat of one of the 30 finalists in this year's Wackiest Pet Name Contest. She's up against Boots with Fur, Chug Chug Pickles, Lulu the Conqueror, Mr. Pizza Puff, and Midsize Sedan, to name a few. According to her owners, Car Alarm is a very vocal cat, thus the name, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Who wins the top title? It's up to the public. You can cast one vote in each of the three categories: top dog, top cat, and top exotic pet name.
Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Today, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced the first drinking water standards for PFAS chemicals, and the new standard could help reduce exposure to the toxic chemicals for some 100 million Americans. WRT reporter David Ahrens has the story.
The drinking water standard was announced today next to the Cape Fear River, the source of drinking water for some 1 million people in North Carolina, and a river that's been polluted by PFAS from a nearby manufacturer. The family of PFAS chemicals ranges in the thousands. The so-called forever chemicals, a name for their persistence or inability to break down in a natural environment. For decades, they've been put in all sorts of industrial and consumer products, everything from dental floss to living room furniture. But they're also toxic. They've been linked to a wide range of cancers and adverse developmental effects with long-term exposure. According to the Biden administration, these new standards are projected to prevent thousands of premature deaths, tens of thousands of serious illnesses, including certain cancers and liver and heart impacts in adults, and immune and developmental impacts to infants and children. When implemented, the new EPA standard will dramatically lower the allowable limit of PFAS in drinking water, including in Wisconsin. The current limit, set by state law, is 70 parts per trillion. The EPA's new maximum is only a fraction of that, at just 4 parts per trillion for the most common PFAS chemicals. In Madison, city officials have already taken steps to limit exposure. Joe Grande is the manager of water quality at the Madison Water Utility. He says the new rules won't cause changes for the city since it's already been proactive about PFAS exposure. Grande referred to the city's Well 15, which is close to the Truax airfield on the east side. That's been shut down for almost 5 years. The city said it was a preventative measure due to community concerns about the chemicals found there. A project to install a PFAS treatment system at the well is expected to cost nearly $6 million. Isthmus reports that half of the cost will be paid through the two class action settlements from the major PFAS producers, 3M and DuPont. This is the first PFAS treatment to be constructed in the state. The EPA's new regulation requires water utilities in the next 3 years to test their water and report to the EPA and the public if the chemicals are found above the limit. In the 2 years after the tests, the utilities are required to reduce the chemicals to the allowable limit. The law includes $1 billion for testing and $9 billion for bringing the level below the limit. The Department of Natural Resources survey of all water utilities in Wisconsin found that 5% exceeded the new federal threshold. Despite the new federal standard, the DNR estimates that it will take about 3 years for the state to adopt that standard. Only after it is adopted can the state enforce it. Meanwhile, the higher standard of 70 parts will remain in effect. Over the last decade, the Republican Legislative Committee overseeing state rules has consistently opposed departmental requests for more protective standards. Meanwhile, $125 million appropriated by the state for PFAS testing and removal, and that was allocated in the state budget last year, is still sitting in the state's bank account. However, federal funds are available through the bipartisan Federal Infrastructure Law for testing and remediation. Steve Elmore, the director of the Drinking and Groundwater Program of the DNR, says that funds are available to communities right now.
So we have results that we can compare to these standards. We will be sending out letters to systems that exceed these standards in the coming months, and I'll particularly make them aware of funding that's available now, federal funding to install treatment or, say, drill a new well that will reduce exposure to PFAS.
Yesterday, Governor Evers vetoed a Republican-backed bill on PFAS, saying that the bill would have curtailed environmental regulators and shifted the cost of cleaning up PFAS contamination to taxpayers rather than polluters. He said a new law isn't necessary for releasing the $125 million already and waiting to be spent. Evers also ordered the Joint Committee on Finance to meet next week to release the money. That attempt was quickly rebuffed by the co-chairs of the Budget Committee, who say that the governor can't compel a committee to meet. For WRT News, I'm David Ahrens.
Renewable energy construction jobs are aplenty right now in Wisconsin. And as these developments take shape, a handful of major utilities are prioritizing union workers to tap into federal incentives. Mike Moen of Wisconsin News Connection has the story.
With the help of federal aid, Wisconsin is catching up to neighboring states and accelerating clean energy construction projects. And the Badger State is taking things a step further by giving union workers greater access to these job opportunities. Four major utilities operating in Wisconsin recently announced a pledge to hire union workers for clean energy development tied to federal incentives under the Inflation Reduction Act. Kent Miller of the Wisconsin Laborers District Council says it paves the way for a smoother transition to more wind, solar, and similar projects.
With the commitment from the utilities to make sure that the wages and benefits are the same standard as legacy energy, it allows workers to focus on updating their skill sets to meet the needs of the project and not worry about are there concessions in wages and benefits.
In earlier phases of renewable energy construction, Miller says some project leaders focused on bringing in out-of-state non-union contractors. Now that Wisconsin labor organizations have a seat at the table, Miller says the next challenge is getting more advance notice before a project breaks ground so they can ramp up recruiting well ahead of time. For example, Miller says a utility-scale solar development requires a lot of labor, and they want as many people as possible to know about potential openings. He says that includes apprenticeships.
Somebody could start their apprenticeship career, complete their apprenticeship, and become a journey worker through the duration of a utility-scale solar project.
He points to the Paris Solar Farm project in Kenosha County, which at its peak had nearly 150 laborers. Of the apprentices, 70% were women or people of color. Analysts say the hiring pledge and associated projects could lead to nearly 19,000 construction jobs that come with prevailing wages. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
It's now 6:20 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. A plaque is said to be installed in Van Hise Hall at the University of Wisconsin, acknowledging that the building's namesake, Charles Van Hise, was a eugenicist. WRT reporter Ella Staff has more.
Charles Van Hise is an important figure in the history of UW-Madison. He was university president in the early 1900s and was one of the co-creators of the Wisconsin Idea. He also promoted eugenics, a method of selectively breeding the human race, often through forced sterilization. Eugenics is based on racist and ableist ideas and associated with genocide. After Casey Lucchini Butcher, director of the Center for Campus History, was contacted by concerned Madison residents, she knew her team had to do something about Van Hise Hall.
And I started this kind of campaign where everywhere I would go, I was like, if you have a story you think we should talk about or something you think we should research, please reach out. I don't know everything about the past. I'm just one person. And we got a lot of emails about people saying, you know, I know about this history with Charles Van Hise, but I don't see anybody else talking about it. And so that was like a big hint for us when we got multiple emails from community members that they felt that this was kind of a neglected history.
Where did the idea for a plaque come from?
Yeah, so we were approached to collaborate on this project with the Committee on Disability Access and Inclusion, which is a shared governance committee at UW-Madison. And due to some work that we had done with the Public History Project, researching the history of the university, and then now with our kind of permanent opening as the Center for Campus History, it just seemed like a really natural collaboration for us, right? To think about the history of the university, which is something that we studied, but more importantly for our center, we're really interested in how the history of our university can be instructive today.
So how did you decide what would go on the plaque?
Oh, it was a complicated process, but it went back and forth between a lot of different people. So we collaborated on it with the CDAI, with the provost, with the chancellor, with the vice provost of teaching and learning. So we had a lot of different people kind of look at it, and we really stepped back and kind of thought about, you know, what are the takeaways that we want people to leave this plaque after reading? And so the reason that I think we went with a plaque for, you know, any way that we could have done this was that we wanted people to at least leave knowing this history about Van Hise.
Mm-hmm. And what did the process of getting the plaque approved look like?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole Board of Regents process to doing plaques. So really, I mean, the CDAI approached me and asked for some of the historical support, and I gave a presentation to them. And then they really worked through this mechanism of taking it up through shared governance and then bringing it to the chancellor, who has the kind of final approval. It also goes through the campus planning committee. There's a lot of different people who this has to like work through before it goes to the chancellor for approval.
Were there any roadblocks in getting this plaque approved? Was anyone in opposition to it?
You know, I don't think opposition's the right word. I think there were like some important points brought up about, you know, why are we doing a plaque? Should we do renaming? Is a plaque really going to do what we want it to do? So it wasn't opposition. I think if anything, the like, you know, conversations that were provoked in trying to get the plaque approved actually demonstrate why we need the plaque. And my goals and in being involved in this as the Center for Campus History is that we should be talking about these things, and that this kind of like way that we approach history where we bury some of these very uncomfortable stories isn't actually serving any of us.
To circle back, why did your team decide not to rename Van Hise Hall?
It wasn't necessarily like a decision was ever made. It was just like there's something I always, and this is what I brought to the CDAI and what I've said publicly when I lecture on this, because I always get the question, why not rename? And there's a couple things. So one of the things that I always pause or hesitate with renaming is that renaming is very controversial right now. So lots of people hear that there's going to be a renaming and they just immediately are like, you know, no, you're erasing this person, you're erasing their legacy. And what you get is a huge controversy for a few years where people are really upset, lots of op-eds, it's everywhere in the newspaper. And in 4 years, nobody remembers what the building was called, why we renamed it. And so one of the questions I ask is, you know, when we have these type of histories, what is your goal in renaming? And when I asked the CDAI, who was considering going for renaming, what was your goal? They said, well, we want to educate people. We want people to know what eugenics is. We want them to know that it's still happening. And we want them to know Van Hise's involvement. And my response was, you know, renaming isn't going to do that.
Hmm. No, that's really thought-provoking. Do you think that UW is doing enough in general to acknowledge Van Hise's role in like eugenics in general and in Wisconsin's like sterilization policies that existed in the past, or do you think like the plaque could be just the beginning of that acknowledgement?
Yeah, the CBAI folks and myself have talked about this. For us, it is the beginning. So the plaque is just a start where we can really begin this conversation. Because right now, where do you get this information, right? Where do you know this about Van Hise? It's not the easiest thing to find. And so for us, this is the first step of really saying, okay, let's get a plaque up so that this provokes that kind of thought, that reflection. And then from there, we can work to do more. And so to me, it's just the beginning of a really, I think, needed conversation about Van Hise's legacy.
So one thing that I came across when I was researching Van Hise was his role in creating the Wisconsin Idea, which, you know, is still so central to like our state's identity. It's part of what connects him to the university still. Do you think that when we're talking about these like controversial figures in history where they like they do some good things, but then their legacy is marred by this like abhorrent stuff, do you think we can somehow separate those two? Like, could the Wisconsin Idea exist like separate from Van Hise?
Yeah, I actually think the Wisconsin Idea already exists separate from Van Hise. I joke with people, but I very much want to do a kind of like Family Feud style ask 100 people on campus who created the Wisconsin Idea. And I guarantee you only probably 10 to 15 people could tell you it was Van Hise. And it's not because they don't care about history. It's because the Wisconsin Idea is bigger than him. It is something that everybody who comes to UW, whether as their student or they're working here as faculty or researchers or staff, every person, department, unit takes the Wisconsin Idea and makes it their own. And so, you know, I think you can credit it to him, but it is so much bigger than him now and has existed so much longer than he's been alive, right? Like, the Wisconsin Idea, I mean, he died over 100 years ago, and the Wisconsin Idea is still here. So I actually think that it is very much separate from him in the way that it's being practiced right now. My only, like, kind of asterisk to that idea is that I think talking about the Wisconsin Idea in conversation with eugenics is really important because it asks us to kind of take that stutter step or that pause, right, and really say, just because we think an idea is good, or just because we think that this idea that we have or this product or this invention could help society, will it do that? What is the intent of this idea and what are the impacts of that idea? Because Van Hise thought that eugenics was going to help society and he thought it was a net good for society. And now we know that it harmed a lot of people. And so if anything, I think that the history of eugenics and Van Hise and the Wisconsin Idea ask us to really commit to the Wisconsin Idea in a way that we practice it that benefits all people, and to really think about how we are going to live up to the Wisconsin Idea and not harm people. So, like, I don't think we should throw out the Wisconsin Idea with Van Hise and eugenics at all. I think they belong in conversation with each other.
Lucchini Butcher says she hopes that the new plaque will educate students about UW's complicated history and Van Hise's legacy. For now, the plaque awaits the approval of UW Chancellor Mnookin before it can be installed in the lobby of Van Hise Hall. Reporting for WORT Local News, I'm Ella Saff.
And you're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Please stay with us. We've got lots more stories coming up.
We learn how the referendums approved last week could impact future elections. We hear from a former curator at Momoka, and we travel back in time to 1962.
But first, we'll take a quick break, check in on some world headlines, and we'll be right back.
In addition to the generous support of listener sponsors, the local businesses and organizations that underwrite WORT's programming play a vital role in the financial health of your community radio station. WORT is grateful for the support of our underwriters, and when you visit these businesses and organizations, please let them know that their support of WORT is appreciated. For information on how to become a WORT underwriter, contact me, Doug Holtz, at 608-256-2001 or visit our website at wortfm.org.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
See news. Three sons of Hamas's political leader Ismail Haniyeh have been killed in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza, but he says their deaths will not change his negotiating position in ceasefire talks. The men were reportedly heading to a family Eid celebration at the time of the attack. Israel said they had carried out what it called terrorist activities. President Biden has promised what he called ironclad support for Israel amid concerns that Iran is about to launch a significant retaliation for the killing of its commanders in Syria last week. Earlier, Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei again said Israel would be punished for the strike on its consulate. The European Parliament has approved an overhaul of the EU's migration and asylum rules. It will see the toughening of border controls and speeding up of deportations. South Korea's Democratic Party has strengthened its majority in Parliament, with nearly all votes counted from Wednesday's election. Together with its smaller ally, it's on course to win over 170 of the 300 seats in the National Assembly. The US and Japan have announced a new era of strategic cooperation. It will see the building of a joint air and missile defense system. The ruling military junta in Mali has suspended all political activities until further notice. More than 80 political parties and civil groups recently called for presidential elections. Rights groups say an indigenous woman has reported Honduras to the UN Human Rights Committee in the first such challenge to its absolute ban on abortion. The woman was raped and forced to give birth. Canada's government says it's preparing for another potentially devastating wildfire season after a warmer than normal winter. BBC News.
Time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton, here with co-host Vicki Iden. Thanks for joining us.
Last week, Wisconsin voters approved both statewide referendums on the ballot. In doing so, they codified two constitutional amendments with conservative backing. But how will this affect election procedure moving forward? WORT news producer Faye Parks spoke to town clerks across the state.
Last Tuesday, 54% of voters signaled their approval for a constitutional amendment that bans the use of outside money for election administration. Now, Wisconsin clerks can no longer accept private donations or grants to run any type of election. But according to Stephanie Zwettler, the town of Black Earth clerk, that's not much of a stumbling block.
We have never gotten private funding.
And it's a similar story for John Roth, the town of Scott clerk. In 2020, the Center for Tech and Civic Life, a Chicago-based advocacy group, offered private election grants to hundreds of municipalities across Wisconsin. According to Roth, several other towns in Brown County applied for the private money, but the town of Scott didn't.
Partly because we, A, didn't need it, and B, we were so busy with the election, I didn't even have a chance to look into it. I think that was the election we had two-thirds of the people voted through the mail or in person.
But Madison did receive some of that private funding in 2020. The city's $1.5 million grant has already been spent, reports the Cap Times. In January, the Common Council approved the purchase of lockable security carts for election equipment and a new $1 million system to process absentee ballots. According to Dane County Clerk Scott McDonnell, there's no way of knowing if private donors might have offered more election funding in the future and are now barred by the state's constitution.
I know the CTCL was planning on phasing out grants. That's what they announced publicly. But, of course, there could be other groups, things in the future that we wouldn't know about.
Wisconsin voters also approved the second referendum on last week's ballot by 58%. It asked voters if election officials who conduct election-related tasks should be appointed by law. The amendment encodes existing state law into the Constitution, and according to Town of Scott clerk, John Roth. They already follow those guidelines.
If we've had some people that can't work an election or we need to add, like on a November one, we get a board approval because you're supposed to do that.
And Town of Black Earth clerk Stephanie Zwettler says they follow the same procedure.
The tasks are either done by the election officials, which are appointed, or by me, town clerk.
But Wisconsin's constitution doesn't define election official. And according to Madison attorney Mike Haas, election officials aren't the only ones that keep things running.
There are two categories that I think of that involve people completing tasks in the conduct of an election. One is city staff that is not in the clerk's office, like the police department, the IT department, public works, staff that temporarily help the clerk's office to put together the absentee ballot mailings or transport ballots to the polls to be counted. And then the second category is outside vendors like printing shops or mail houses or delivery truck drivers or staff of the polling facilities that are not city facilities.
So the question is, are all of those people now considered election officials? The second referendum's language is vague and doesn't give any direction about outside vendors. Since the state legislature is out of session and can't provide guidance, Scott McDonald says it's up to the Wisconsin Elections Commission.
They often deadlock, so I don't know whether that will happen, but it's kind of uncharted waters for us.
The Wisconsin Elections Commission could decide to issue additional guidance for Wisconsin's 1,000-plus clerks. If so, that would come after this election has been certified, spokesperson Riley Vetterkind tells WORT. But with 4 months to go until the primary in August, the clock is ticking. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
It's now 6:37 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
This week, Framing Culture's host, Jose Teixeira, talks with Leah Kolb, former curator of exhibitions at Momoca. They discuss how she became a curator, her past work in Madison, and her thoughts on the city's culture and community.
Framing Culture. Hello, good evening, and welcome to one more episode of Framing Culture. Today, I have the true pleasure of welcoming to the program Leah Kolb.
Hi, Jose. It's great to be here.
Thank you so much for accepting the invitation, Leah. For those at home, we are actually speaking on Zoom. So Leah is now in
Lexington, Kentucky.
And I'm here in Madison, Wisconsin. I met you many years ago to discuss potential projects for the Wisconsin Triennial 2013, remember?
I remember clearly, yes. I remember going to your studio in the Humanities Building, right? Or yeah.
That's right.
And I was really blown away by the work that you showed me. And I thought it was really moving and it powerful. And it was a pleasure from the beginning.
Likewise. And I can say that about you. I think that a lot of us agree that you are really an amazing exception in the world of curators and cultural agents, because you are very available, very honest, genuine, and warm in your approach. And not only that, you are extremely intelligent. So all of that combined makes you an interesting person to know and to work with. So thank you so much, Leah. I would like to start the conversation asking you about your beginnings. So what did you study? And actually, how did you decide to become a curator in the arts and overall a cultural agent?
I took a bit of a circuitous, non-traditional route to this curatorial world when I wouldn't necessarily recommend, but it's worked out so far. I have my undergraduate degree in history, and my graduate degree, my first master's degree, was in archival studies. And I was studying to get my master's when I was hired by the former curator at MoCA, the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, Jane Simon, who's now in Florida. And I really have to credit pretty much my start to her, certainly, and also to Steve Fleischman, the former director of MoCA, who passed away this past year, tragically. And also to Rick Axum, who was the curator emeritus at MoCA, and he retired, I think, 18 or 19. I don't know, the time just flies, doesn't it? Anyway, so I started working there part-time when I was in grad school as a curatorial research assistant for Jane Simon. During that time working for her, she let me curate a couple shows from the permanent collection, and it really became this way of taking a lot of the skills that I was learning archivally, right, of taking a lot of information, condensing it, picking out the most important things and presenting it and making it accessible to the public through an approachable narrative, right? That can reach as many types of populations and different levels of understanding and apply that into the art world. And so I don't have that kind of formal art historical background. A lot of that I, you know, learned by doing and also by reading a lot and going to museums and teaching myself.
So do you feel that initial process at MoCA was somehow leading you to new paths that previously you didn't imagine for yourself?
100%. Yeah. I mean, I went to graduate school with the dream of being an archivist at an art museum. So I always loved art, but I thought I was going to be, you know, working in an archive. I kind of had this fantasy of working at the Walker Art Center in their library and archive because it's pretty phenomenal.
Yes.
But I realized, you know, by having this opportunity at MoCA that I guess the joy I got from the archival standpoint, where you're able to do research and like really dig in and dive into learning new things, right, with each, in that case, collection you were processing, in the, you know, in this case, like the show that you're working on, it gave you this opportunity that was also much more forward facing, where you got to interact more with humans as opposed to documents. And mm-hmm. I think for me, it was that human connection and also like working directly with artists and then being able to interact with the public and learn from all of that. It certainly was a learning process for me because I'd never imagined that this could actually be a career that I would take on.
Would you say, Leah, that it was the human connection with the artist and subsequently with the whole community that was the most enticing and more exciting thing for you?
I think that that's very accurate. There's this thing that happens when you're working with an artist on a show where you have, you know, over the course of many conversations and studio visits and really trying to get into their head a little bit in order to represent the work in the best way possible that honors the artist and the artist's work, but doing it in a way that is also accessible to the public. When you get to this point where even for a minute, you can kind of almost like see the world through that artist's eyes is just, it's kind of a beautiful thing. And I think for me, that was really incredibly rewarding. And then being able to figure out, hopefully, right, a way to present that to a public and allow that to happen for them too.
Since we are talking about MoCA and you were a curator here for many, many years, is there a moment or two or a project that for you was most memorable or an experience that was particularly enriching to you?
Well, of course, the show that we worked on together, Jose.
Oh, thank you. Well, I was not thinking of that, but that flatters me. Thank you so much.
You know, it's so hard to say because every show, particularly the ones, because I did a lot of solo exhibitions with artists, right, where either like the work existed, but most of the times it didn't exist and it was sort of more of a site-specific engagement or they were creating a new body of work. And there's a lot of kind of anxiety that comes with that, but also excitement. But I would have to say that the one that probably was the most meaningful for me was with an artist named Jim Cagle. And he called me, I had met him again through one of the, I think it was the 2013 triennial as well. We had this, he was a photographer in Sturgeon Bay, had worked at St. Norbert College for many, many years. He called me and he told me that he was dying of cancer.
Oh, wow.
in his this process of sort of coming to terms with his death, he's had this like burst of creative energy, and he really wanted to create this project, this photographic project, and be able to show it sort of almost like as a swan song. And it was really difficult, obviously, to work on that with him, because you're working on it knowing that, you know, will he live to see it installed, right? And then COVID hit too during that whole time. So it was up, but it didn't really get the same amount of attention necessarily as it could have, just because of the whole COVID situation. But he was able to see the show, which ended up being not only that specific project, but also a handful of other photographs that the museum had acquired from him over the years. And so it was really kind of a beautiful tribute to be able to honor him and his contributions to art, particularly in Wisconsin.
I can imagine that such a project is simultaneously a very important professional enterprise, but also a deeply intimate personal path with a person that is at the end of life. So thank you so much for sharing that. And since you were mentioning the Madison area, I would like to ask you, and please feel free to share as much as you want, what are your critical thoughts about things to improve and to perhaps change in the community of Madison when it comes to not only the visual arts, but the arts in general? In a state in which you have such a low funding, public funding in the arts, how do you see your thoughts on things to improve and change in the Madison arts community and infrastructure, so to speak?
You know, I was lucky enough to work, you know, dealing with the complexities of working within an institution, and particularly an institution that had been around since 1901. And I think that it's unusual for a city the size of Madison to have two museums, right? You've got the Chazen, which is an incredible university museum with an amazing collection. You've got Amoca, right, which also has a pretty interesting collection, very different focus on modern and contemporary, that primarily focuses, at least, you know, on rotating exhibitions, not only with the collection, but with contemporary artists. Or what I saw a lot of in Madison was this sort of drive for there to be more opportunities for local artists to show. And certainly, you know, there were those opportunities from an institutional standpoint, although for any museum, there has to be a balance, right, between local, national, international. And so I think that leaves the local part of it not always feeling as loved as they could, right? Or they should. What I always found really interesting, though, is there didn't seem to be a whole lot of energy around, you know, the local artists creating or local cultural producers wanting to sort of create their own, whether it would be a venue or a pop-up space. I mean, of course, you've got people like Trent Miller who with the Bubbler, you've got the Art Lit Lab, right? So you started to see some of this momentum happening. But I think what I find really interesting here in Lexington, and what I've been able to do here, which is kind of, which has been incredibly rewarding, is just starting something.
End of part one. Stay tuned for part two with Leah Kolb in the next episode of Framing Culture.
We go now to April 1962 for the death of Frank Lloyd Wright's Monona Terrace, the birth of the Madison City flag, and an important Daily Cardinal editorial about Vietnam. Stu Levitan is your time traveler on tonight's Madison in the 60s.
They melt into a dream.
Madison in the 60s, April 1962. Henry Reynolds was elected mayor in April 1961 on a platform of killing the Frank Lloyd Wright Monona Terrace Public Auditorium and Civic Center. That project was created by referendum in 1954, and that's the only way it can be abandoned. So Reynolds drafts and pushes through the council a referendum to do just that, to formally reject the Law Park location and start the process of picking a new site. On April 3rd, the referendum passes with about 54% of the vote. As a bonus for Reynolds, three pro-Terrace alders are defeated, although over local issues, not Monona Terrace. That gives the city a government unified against Monona Terrace. The mayor moves fast, calling a meeting of the auditorium committee just 3 days after the vote to start the process of terminating the contract, which former Mayor Ivan Nestegan and Mr. Wright signed in 1956. And when the new council convenes on April 17th, Reynolds presses his advantage. He does not reappoint the leading pro-project alder, Northsider Richard Kopp, and stacks the panel with three aldermanic opponents. The next day, the fervently pro-Monona Terrace Capital Times expresses its outrage. A dictator is taken over in City Hall and asserts he has been given a mandate to suspend minority rights, it editorializes, denouncing Reynolds' refusal to reappoint Kopp as, quote, a display of petulance and anger. The auditorium committee isn't the only place Reynolds flexes his mayoral muscle. He also shakes up the Mayor's Commission on Human Rights by not reappointing its chair, attorney and NAACP president Lloyd Barbie, a Nestegan appointee. The commission chooses as its new leader the pastor at Westminster Presbyterian Church, the Reverend Richard Pritchard. Election Day also brings good referendum news to the school board, as voters adopt by 4-1 a 4-year, $9.3 million bond package, the largest in city history. Most will be spent on the Far East Side, including $4.4 million for the 2,400 students in the area Madison just annexed from Blooming Grove, and $3.1 million for the newly named Robert M. La Follette High School. The sixth successful bond referendum since the end of World War II, it is approved by a substantial majority in all 33 voting precincts. But there's a limit to how many buildings the board will boost. It endorses the recommendation from Superintendent Philip Falk to not remodel or renovate the 1908 Central High School, which they project will stay open for at least another 10 years. I don't think we can justify large expenditures in an area of decreasing population, Falk tells the board. He also proposes moving the board offices from the old Doty School on West Wilson Street into the Washington School on West Dayton Street. It's an exciting month on the UW campus. On the 1st and 2nd, violinist Isaac Stern performs outstanding programs at two sold-out shows in the Union Theater. April 2nd is quite a night in the historic building. Over in Great Hall, Black Muslim minister Malcolm X is extolling Black nationalism to a group of about 500. Great Hall is also the site for Duke Ellington and his 15-piece orchestra to headline the Military Ball on the 5th and the Student Peace Center's Anti-Military Ball on the 6th. On the 11th, the Daily Cardinal demands that the government explain exactly what it's doing in South Vietnam and why. It is pretty clear by now, the paper editorializes, that the American effort in South Vietnam is of a far more serious nature than has been indicated by our government. The administration has, in effect, thrown American military might into South Vietnam without consulting and without informing the American people or their representatives. The Cardinals, led by 19-year-old Jeff Greenfield, the paper's first sophomore editor-in-chief in its 70-year history. 2 days later, the UW Board of Visitors reports to the Regents that it has examined the Daily Cardinal and, quote, noted a number of instances of a low standard of taste and an equally low concept of good citizenship. On April 12th, a strike by about 120 truck drivers shuts down $120 million in construction for almost a month, as members of Teamster Local 695 strike 15 ready-mix concrete and building supply firms for higher wages and benefits. As picket lines go up at Findorff and other general contractors, work stops on the Hilldale Shopping Center, the Van Vleck Mathematics Building, an addition to Madison General Hospital, and more. At Governor Gaylord Nelson's request, UW Law Professor Nathan S. Feinsinger mediates a settlement which provides a raise of 56 cents over a 3-year period. From a starting hourly wage of $2.65, the union had sought a 66-cent increase. The employers offered 50 cents. The same night the strike starts, the city council unanimously adopts a work relief ordinance requiring all able-bodied relief recipients to work on city-supervised projects or take vocational training in order to receive relief. The $1.47 hourly wage is set at 80% of the city's lowest pay classification. It's payable in vouchers for food and housing rather than cash. The ordinance also creates a 7-member Board of Public Welfare in control of the program. The council also adopts the first official city flag, designed by two young members of the Madison Scouts Drum and Bugle Corps, Rick and Dennis Stone, and sewn by their mother, Frances. It consists of two blue triangles representing Lakes Mendota and Monona, a stripe of white running from lower left to upper right to represent the isthmus, and the sacred sun symbol of the Zia Pueblo Nation emblazoned in gold on a black background to represent the state capital. After its approval, the flag hangs upside down in the council chambers for over 3 years until City Attorney Edwin Conrad notices a mistake and corrects it. And at the end of the month, the council finally settles a long-standing debate over where to locate the new central library, voting 12-7 for the 200 block of West Mifflin Street. The library board wanted a site in the 200 block of West Washington Avenue, across from the YMCA, but the land was too expensive. Once the library moves from its building on North Carroll Street across from the vocational school, that site will be used to expand the municipal parking ramp there. And that's this week's Madison the 60s. For your award-winning, listener-supported, library-loving WORT news team, I'm Stu Levitan.
And that's a wrap for WORT's live local news at 6. Your headline writer was Greg Sanderson. Your reporters were David Ahrens and Ella Saft, and Mike Mullen with the Wisconsin News Connection. Special thanks to feature contributors Jose Carlos Textiera and Stu Levitan. Katie Jergella engineered tonight's podcast. Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Michelle Pittman is the news director here at WORT. Thank you guys for listening. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton.
And I'm your host, Vicki Iden. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Good night.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
In addition to the generous support of listener sponsors, the local businesses and organizations that underwrite WORT's programming play a vital role in the financial health of your community radio station. WORT is grateful for the support of our underwriters, and when you visit these businesses and organizations, please let them know that their support of WORT is appreciated. For information on how to become a WORT underwriter, contact me, Doug Holtz, at 608-256-2001 or visit our website at wortfm.org.
The following program is syndicated. Please excuse any dated references. You're listening to WORT Madison.